stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Michael Brown reporting. The entire Russian team has been banned from the Paralympic Games in September. The stiffer penalties stem from Russia's systematic doping program that is keeping some Russian athletes out of the current Summer Olympiad in Rio de Janeiro. The Paralympic Games is conducted for athletes with a range of physical disabilities. Day two of the Games in Brazil has the most decorated athlete in Olympic history, Michael Phelps, competing in the 4x100-meter freestyle relay. In women's U.S. swimming, they picked up a first medal in the 4x100 freestyle on Saturday. This year's Olympic series features a team of athletes who took a unique journey to the Games.
That idea that you can succeed no matter where you're from is especially true this year. We'll cheer on athletes on the first ever Olympic refugee team. 10 competitors from the Congo, Ethiopia, South Sudan, and Syria who personify endurance.
U.S. President Barack Obama. Syrian rebels Sunday broke a three-week government hold on the embattled city of Aleppo, a major military setback for forces loyal to President Bashar al-Assad. The advance was marked by celebrations among civilians and rebel fighters, but there were fears of food shortages in western areas still held by government forces. Pope Francis condemned the continued fighting in Syria, saying it's unacceptable that so many helpless, including many children, must pay the price of the conflict, the price of closed hearts, and the lack of desire for peace by the powerful. This is VOA News. Voters in Thailand Sunday approved a military-backed constitution opening the way for new elections, but critics see the vote as legitimizing the military's role in government for years to come. A spokesman for the New Democracy Movement said they continue to oppose the constitution, adding that they call on the government to revise what they believe is an unjust document. The junta-backed draft would create an unelected prime minister during political gridlock, as well as an unelected Senate with reserved seats for the junta. Prior to Sunday's vote, the military used laws supporting the referendum to fine and imprison people up to 10 years for campaigning against the draft. Iran has executed a nuclear scientist who was convicted of giving top-secret information about Tehran's controversial nuclear program to the United States. The execution of Shahram Amiri was confirmed Sunday by Iran's official news agency. A U.S. official said in 2010, the U.S. received useful information from Amiri. South African President Jacob Zuma, reeling from historic losses in local elections, says voters are sending out messages all around and that his ruling African National Congress is going to listen very, very carefully.
These elections were hotly contested, with competing parties passionately arguing their points of view in attempts to win the favor of the electorate. That is how it should be in a democracy.
Zuma spoke as vote tallies showed the ANC losing control of the capital, Pretoria, and its majority in the second largest city, the country's largest city, that is, an economic center, Johannesburg. The party of Nelson Mandela already had conceded defeat in Port Elizabeth. Hundreds of thousands of people rallied in Istanbul Sunday in support of Turkish President Recep Erdogan. The rally follows weeks of demonstrations after last month's aborted coup that claimed the lives of more than 270 people, including 34 who helped plan the coup. Erdogan invited opposition leaders to attend the rally, except the head of the pro-Kurdish People's Democratic Party. An extremely powerful storms have claimed the lives of at least 17 people in the Macedonian capital of Skopje. At least six people are missing. Dozens more have been hospitalized. Authorities say the death toll could rise as the government plans to issue a state of emergency for 2 weeks in the most affected areas. Again, recapping our top story, hundreds of thousands of people rallying in Istanbul in support of the president, President Erdogan, and the entire Russian team banned from the Paralympic Games in September. I'm Michael Brown reporting in Washington. More news at voanews.com.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Today, the mission is providing protection to approximately 200,000 civilians. And these are civilians in the six protection of civilian locations that we have throughout the country.
The South Sudanese government accepts the deployment of additional foreign troops unconditionally.
Our findings were actually looking at the press freedom situation in advance of the election, and we were motivated to go to Zambia by the government's seizure of the offices and printing press.
The International Press Institute expresses concern about press freedom in Zambia.
They say they don't have any information. Those who arrested them simply came and arrested them without telling them the charge or any allegations.
And the Zimbabwean police arrest 14 protesters. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. South Sudanese President Salva Kiir has accepted the deployment of additional foreign troops from regional countries to help protect and boost the fighting capacity of the United Nations mission, or UNMISS. The new additional force would also help defend civilians at risk of extreme violence. This as the security situation in the country remains tense following the recent clashes between opposing forces loyal to both President Kiir and Dr. Riek Machar. I read Chantal Pissard, the spokesperson for UNMISS, about the current situation in the country and particularly in the capital, Juba.
Well, we are concerned about the security situation in the country, which currently remains quite volatile. And while the ceasefire agreement, which came into effect on July 11th, appears to generally be holding in Juba, we are continuing to receive reports of tensions elsewhere in the country and renewed clashes in the Equatorias, and also reports of some sporadic fighting over the last week or so in the greater Upper Nile region.
Now, let me ask you about UNMISS's position on the protection of unarmed civilians.
Protection of civilians is very much the core priority of the mission, and this includes protecting the most vulnerable. So currently today, the mission is providing protection to approximately 200,000 civilians. And these are civilians in the six protection of civilian locations that we have throughout the country. And these are the protection of civilian sites that were established as a result of the 2013 conflict. And in Juba, during and after the recent conflict, the mission's peacekeeping personnel provided security for the protection sites and other UN facilities throughout the country. So in order to help improve the security for women and children, which are obviously the most vulnerable, who are residing in the UNMISS protection sites, the mission has intensified its patrols in and around the POC sites, as well as in the general wider Juba city area. So we are engaged to ensure that these POC sites remain secure. That's the objective. And with the support of protection of civilian community watch groups within these POC sites and community leaders, the mission conducts search operations within the sites, where contraband and any other offensive weapons that are found are confiscated. And this is just generally in helping to keep with the character and the nature of the site, in that they are civilian and humanitarian.
Chantal, I wanted to ask you what UNMISS is doing about allegations of sexual abuse and gang rape, usually blamed on the military or soldiers for that matter.
There are cases of horrendous and unacceptable acts of sexual violence that were committed both during and after the recent conflict in Juba. And these were carried out by soldiers in uniform and also men in plain clothes against civilians around the POC sites here in Juba and other areas in the city. So the mission to date, we've documented over 100 of these incidents where women and girls who were essentially going to the market were either raped or gang raped and robbed of their personal items that they had on them or beaten up or verbally abused by soldiers and other security officers that were at the various checkpoints along the way, along the route into the city. So the mission has put in place a number of mitigating measures to help protect the more vulnerable of these communities inside the POC sites. So what we're doing is we're conducting coordinated escort patrols in Juba. And in Juba, we have two protection of civilian sites, and we refer to them as POC 1 and POC 3.
What are some of the restrictions that the mission faces in South Sudan?
Well, freedom of movement for both the civilian peacekeepers and the uniformed peacekeepers remains a big issue. And we are continuing to face restrictions throughout Juba. And more recently, in fact, at the end of July last month, we were informed by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in a written communication that the mission has to give at least 72 hours notice to any UNMIT personnel in advance of their arrival into the country. Otherwise, they will face refusal of entry. So as you can imagine, this restrictions and other restrictions on our uniformed personnel can cause a lot of disruptions to our operation, not only stress and additional costs to staff with these recent immigration restrictions, and they require a huge amount of resources and manpower to manage internally.
Chantal Pessard is the spokesperson for United Nations Mission in South Sudan, or UNMISS. She spoke with me from the capital, Juba. The International Press Institute has expressed concern about press freedom in Zambia. This as the Southern African country goes to the polls in the upcoming August 11 general election and referendum. In a newly released report, the International Press Institute says the government in Lusaka used its influence to enable the Zambia Revenue Authority to shut down production of the Post newspaper and seize its offices. The government denies the allegations. For more on the report, I read Stephen Ellis, the Director of Advocacy and Communications at the International Press Institute.
Our findings were actually looking at the press freedom situation in advance of the election, and we were motivated to go to Zambia by the government's seizure of the offices and printing press of the Post. And our findings are that the case that the government has advanced against this opposition newspaper do not appear to be based on taxes, as the government has said. Instead, the paper has suffered not only the seizure of its most vital assets, but those who are helping it to continue printing have faced harassment, and other media outlets that have similar debts are not subject to the same sort of collection activity by the government. Coming in an environment where there's been a number of incidents of pressure on other media outlets in the last year, and where we've seen a sharp uptick in political violence, it left us extremely concerned about the state of democracy in Zambia and what this might mean for the future.
Well, Stephen, officials of the administration that I spoke to said, why wouldn't the Post publishers just pay their taxes just like any other businesses? Why not settle that debt and then continue publishing?
They want to. We spoke with the Post, and we also spoke with representatives of the government who made that argument. Right now, the Post cannot actually access its bank accounts because they're frozen. So even if it decided that it wanted today to pay off the full debt, it couldn't do that because the Zambian Revenue Authority will not even sit down and talk to it. There's a court order by the Tax Appeals Tribunal directing the government to give back the premises and directing the Post to make at least partial payment right now on what it actually believes it owes and to turn over security for the entire amount in order to guarantee that it will be paid while the Revenue Appeals or the Tax Appeals Tribunal considers the matter. Unfortunately, the Revenue Authority will not sit down with the Post. The Post isn't able to actually make any payments. And it's most important to note that the Post doesn't deny that it might owe some taxes. It's just that it disputes the amount. It feels that what the Revenue Authority has levied, the amount, is incorrect.
Well, the situation is that the government has denied some findings that there were political machinations in this just to undermine the newspaper because it's been critical of some of its activities. Why is there an insistence that there are all kinds of political calculations by the government to undermine the paper?
It's just the totality of the circumstances. The fact that they refuse to sit down and work with the Post to work out the tax issue, to arrive at a correct amount, to allow the Post to pay. The fact that the government has been pressuring anyone else who attempts to give support to the Post, especially those who have printed it while this shutdown is ongoing, and the fact that the government does not take similar measures against other media outlets that owe similar debts. Under the circumstances, all of that combined with the amount of pressure that we've seen on media outlets in general over the last year, we cannot see any other explanation but for the fact that the government wants this paper silent in advance of the election.
Supporters of the government of the Patriotic Front Party, the ruling party, has said that those organizations or individuals helping the Post newspaper barred from printing to go ahead and print and circulate are aiding and abetting criminality and undermining the laws of Zambia. What do you say to that?
I say that sounds somewhat ridiculous. There's no court order preventing the Post from publishing. And to the extent that the government has advanced any justification for this case, is that the Post needs to pay taxes. It's never said that the Post is engaging in illegal activities as far as publishing. It's never maintained that the Post presents some sort of threat to public order. Other individuals are merely helping a business continue to carry out its activities. To the extent that there is any merit to the allegations that the Post has failed to pay taxes, again, that has nothing to do with other individuals helping it to publish a newspaper. And the onus is on the government to sit down with the Post to work out the amount and allow the Post to pay off the taxes that it actually does owe, which the newspaper wants to do.
What is the International Press Institute's call to resolve this impasse?
Is for the Zambian Revenue Authority and the Post to sit down to both comply with the order by the Tax Appeals Tribunal, to work out how much is owed, to work with the court to allow it to make a fair ruling and to give the Post a fair and independent review of the amounts that the Revenue Authority says is owed, to follow that process and to allow the newspaper to do what it needs to do. And the very first step in that process is the government needs to obey or comply with the court order by the Tax Appeals Tribunal to give the Post back its offices and printing press.
Stephen Ellis is the Director of Advocacy and Communications at the International Press Institute. He spoke with me from the Austrian capital, Vienna. Zimbabwean police arrested 14 protesters Saturday during a New Zealand-Zimbabwe cricket match. For VOA, Sebastian Mhofu has more from the Zimbabwean city of Bulawayo.
It all started with their national anthem and waving Zimbabwe's flag during a New Zealand-Zimbabwe cricket match and ended with the arrests. Oh, The singing of the national anthem in the 36th over was part of a protest calling on President Robert Mugabe, 36 years in power, to respect human rights and fix the ailing economy. Lizwe Jamela is with the Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights, which is representing the arrested demonstrators. He said they had not been told of their charges.
So at the moment, we are dealing with an unlawful arrest and unlawful detention. There's no charge. Police, even the police who are taking care of those who have been detained, they don't even know. They say they don't have any information. Those who arrested them simply came and arrested them without telling them the charge or any allegation.
Zimbabwe is in the midst of an unprecedented wave of opposition to President Mugabe, who has been in power since 1980, when the country got its independence from the United Kingdom. The Saturday demonstration was organized by the This Flag movement, which is led by Pastor Ivan Mawarire, who fled to neighboring South Africa last month after he was acquitted of charges of trying to topple President Mugabe's government. Sebastian Mofu, VOA News, Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
Meanwhile, Zimbabweans who attended an outreach meeting convened by the Human Rights Commission say the organization should engage the police and the Zimbabwean National Army, which are alleged to be the top human rights violators in the country. For VOA, Arthur Chigoriwa attended the meeting and filed this report.
Speaking at the gathering in Chinoi, local resident Cleopatra Mubumbi said the commission should ensure that these state institutions need to clearly know their limits in handling members of the public.
Commission should educate the police about human rights, because taking my driver's license, keeping it on him, go around my car and demand things like come out of your car, show me your spare wheel, and yet my spare wheel is right at the back of my car because my car is a 4x4. He can see it, but he would like me to take him to the car. That on its own is abuse, is time taking, and I don't think it's proper.
The sentiments were echoed by another local participant, political activist Tendai Musonza, who added that members of the police and the army need basic education in human rights issues.
The most perpetrators of human rights abuse are the uniformed forces, especially the police. So this workshop should have been directed to them first before it came to us.
One of the commissioners, Petuna Chiriseri, told the gathering that they are also worried about police brutality. Chiriseri said the commission has already engaged Police Commissioner General Augustine Chiuri about the beating up of four vets and demonstrators last month by the police.
That is the role of our chairman. He was the first one to pick up the phone to personally engage the Police Commissioner General on the issue, and there are pending meetings concerning that.
Chiriseri said the issue of brutality being perpetrated by uniformed forces has come up in almost all outreach meetings which have been conducted by the commission. He said the commission is in the process of rolling out an outreach program targeted at the uniformed forces, community leaders and students.
But not just to engage civil society and rural district councils, but also civil servants, uniformed forces, state security agents, traditional leaders, religious leaders, political leaders, educational leaders, teachers, lecturers, and students themselves, so that we not only make ourselves accessible, but also so that we can together build a Zimbabwe that is not only united, but that is harmonious, and that can establish peace and stability in our nation.
Mrs. Karukaira Tsauka, Chief Human Rights Officer of the Zimbabwe Human Rights Commission, said the organization has taken over the work of the ombudsman.
When we took over the public protector role, we took over many cases which the public protector department were looking at. We have cleared a number of them. Some could have prescribed as well. So we have cleared many of the cases to do with the backlog, but we haven't completed the process so far.
Chiriseri urged Zimbabweans not to concentrate only on political rights, but to other rights like rights to food, water, education and health. Some residents questioned the independence of the institution, considering that commissioners are appointed by President Robert Mugabe Mugabe, whose ZANU-PF party members are accused of allegedly perpetrating violence against opposition activists. Zimbabwe Human Rights Commission, which was created by the new constitution in 2010, has not been functional due to lack of resources. So far, 482 cases of human rights violations have been brought before the commission. This is Atach Goriwa.
The average American eats a lot of meat, especially red meat. Meat packs a lot of protein, but as VOA's Carol Pearson reports, if you want to have a long, healthy life, you should get more of your protein from plants.
The hamburger is as American as, well, the 4th of July. There's no doubt that Americans love their burgers, but new research shows they should love them a little less. Doctors Ming-Yong Song and Andrew Chan from Massachusetts General Hospital were among those who examined how animal and plant-based protein impact people's health. They studied data from two major long-term studies involving more than 130,000 participants. The researchers gathered detailed information on the participants' diets, lifestyles, and health, and after thorough analysis, Chan and Song said they came to this conclusion. First, Dr. Chan.
Individuals that consume the highest amounts of animal-based proteins had a somewhat higher risk of mortality, in particular cardiovascular mortality.
And this association is stronger among people with unhealthy lifestyle factors.
Protein helps build and repair muscles and bones. It's essential. But red meat especially is high in cholesterol, a risk factor in heart disease. The researchers found that cardiovascular problems were higher among people who not only ate meat, but also smoked, drank heavily, were obese, or sedentary. Chan said they also found that people who replaced animal protein with plant protein reduced their risk of premature death.
Clearly, over the long term, a diet which is comprised primarily of plant-based proteins tends to be more favorable for longevity than someone who consumes most of their protein from animal sources.
The study appears in JAMA, Internal Medicine. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
Next week on Straight Talk Africa, Shaka Sali and his guests discuss Zambia's general election set for August 11th. The office of the president and seats in the National Assembly are being contested. A constitutional referendum will be held with proposals to amend the nation's Bill of Rights. That's next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa. Next on Let's Talk, absentee parents, a serious issue that affects the lives of the children and parents alike all over the world. What are the reasons and consequences? Join host Sandy Shomari and his guests discussing absentee parents. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Batty, host of your breakfast show, Daybreak Africa. As always, our newsroom is on top of the news of your interest. We provide you with up-to-the-minute news about Africa as well as world news. Tune in to our show right here on VOA Africa, your trusted source of news and information.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is The Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotin, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. Enjoy.
Cause they had a club. I said, she's in the fuck. lot. Now me they sing song about like King Kong. Iye Calabar, Iye Calabar, Iye Calabar, Iye Calabar, Iye Calabar.
Nonya piso bokeje, agana wanse yembe elost, eloska, elost, eloska. Kaya moto yedi moto, fumuto nika yedi ka. Bokonfere citizen, ashawo bastard, abanaya. Why? Because I'm andiongo, sometimes I funke kirong skin. Amadako, let's go. Basita baya. I go Calabar, I see girls with a bad yo. He dash me body, I go baller for Lagos. I call Lorenzi, say I don't have a people club. Where all the babies, say where they call they are dead club. I say she's E40, he's not. Now me they sing song, I'm bad like King Kong. He ain't Calabar, he ain't Calabar.
Chop money.
It's good to be saving for rainy days.
Not so,
cause you know easy.
Life is so delicate. Oh, oh, oh. So make una see me as evidence. Papa God, mama confidence. Yes. His blessings are endless. Oh. As if he said, I don't go. Oh. Some people they bubble. Oh. Hey. I continue the struggle. Oh. The struggle they double my hustle. Oh. Hey. As if he said, I don't go. Oh. Some people they bubble. Oh. Hey. I continue the struggle. Oh. They double my hustle. Yeah. Now I'm giving my testimony. Testimony, hey. Now my testimony, testimony, my testimony. I don't drop, I don't testimony. Hey. I don't testimony. Hey. Now my testimony, testimony, my testimony. I don't drop, I don't testimony. Hey. I don't testimony. Hey. Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3. Hey. Okay. Je m'appelle Chop Money.
As if he said, I don't go. Some people they bubble. I continue the struggle. The struggle they double my hustle. As if he said, I don't go. Some people they bubble. I continue the struggle. They double my hustle. Now I'm giving my testimony. I'm killing the beat and I'm giving them heat.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America.
Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The much anticipated and closely watched municipal elections in South Africa are now history. There are two ways to interpret the results. But before that, we must bear in mind that these elections were local elections and the focus was mostly on service delivery issues. It would be a grave risk to misinterpret the results for national presidential election that will take place in 2019. In the first interpretation, there is no doubt that the African National Congress, ANC, lost considerable grounds to the opposition Democratic Alliance. Most bitter for the ANC was the loss of the metropole Nelson Mandela base. Furthermore, the ANC is being challenged very closely by the DA, the Democratic Alliance, in Johannesburg, the commercial capital, and Pretoria, the administrative capital. It is also true from an analysis of the initial publications of results that much of the votes garnered by the DA are coming not so much from the ANC, but from the collapse of the party COPE, C-O-P-E, which broke away from the ANC years ago. It is also likely that most of the independent candidates in and around Johannesburg and Pretoria took votes from the ANC. Now, the second interpretation. It is clear that South Africa is now moving to a more mature democratic dispensation. By that I mean that you cannot see in any mature democracy a lopsided result. So it is not surprising that in a major democratic context, the ANC has dropped from its usual 62% of the votes to now 54%. It is also necessary to bear in mind that in mature democracies, ruling parties lose seats in midterm elections or municipal election after the votes. For example, President Obama won very big in 2008, but lost very, very significantly in 2010, midterm election in the United States, and was able to win again in 2012. Also in the United Kingdom, the governing party often lose very big in municipal elections. And it is therefore very important that one looks at what now transpired. It is possible that the parties will have to negotiate on the governing coalition either in Johannesburg and Pretoria. But there should be no doubt that the Democratic Alliance made very important gains in its traditional base of the Western Cape. It also moved outside of the Western Cape and is now challenging the ANC in the rest of South Africa. Thirdly, the ANC will have to make a serious analysis of the manner in which it governs in South Africa. This is the lesson that they should have: corruption, mismanagement, and a failure to take care of those who live in the central city. The African National Congress, the ruling party, should be very mindful of the concerns of the South African people, and more attention should be paid to them. But it's a far cry to see the Democratic Alliance challenging the ANC in the next presidential election. Right now, they are around 32% of the national vote. Thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. And from the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, the affable Michael Dubinsky, we say thanks for joining us. I remember, as the elders say, a leader does not listen to rumors. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In Nigeria, the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, has launched two new partnerships with local agribusinesses, Baban Gona and Hello Tractor. These two new projects highlight the U.S. government's commitment to agriculture-led economic growth and private sector engagement as part of Feed the Future, the U.S. government's Global Hunger and Food Security Initiative. This $2 million two-year partnership will allow 45,000 smallholder farmers across seven states and the Federal Capital Territory easier access to smart tractors that better meet their needs, improved seeds, and profitable food and agriculture markets. During the ceremony at the U.S. Embassy in Abuja in late July, which was attended by Nigerian Minister of Agriculture, Audu Ogbe, U.S. Deputy Chief of Mission Maria Brewer described the partnership as a co-investment in public goods. Innovation and entrepreneurship hold the key to unlocking Nigeria's agricultural potential, and the U.S. government will continue to provide support in this direction, said Ms. Brewer. Under the Feed the Future initiative, the U.S. government collaborates with a wide range of partners, from civil society groups to host country governments to the private sector, to support smallholder farmers in Nigeria and other countries across Africa, Asia, Latin America, and the Caribbean. Through these partnerships, Feed the Future addresses development and business challenges by increasing access to improved agricultural inputs and mechanization, better quality technical advisory services, and expanding market opportunities for smallholder farmers. These partnerships capitalize on the untapped potential of youth in agriculture and help build the capacity of young entrepreneurs to help grow their businesses, create secure jobs, and boost economic growth. Through the partnership with USAID, Baban Gona will help 20,000 smallholder farmers, and Feed the Future's partnership with Hello Tractor will enable 24,500 smallholder farmers to gain access to tractor services, as well as train 100 youth entrepreneurs on owning and maintaining a fleet of smart tractors. In its partnership with Nigeria, the United States helps stabilize Nigerian society with improved social services, supports transparent and accountable governance as a responsible regional and trade partner.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.